Suddenly it all kicked off. From the command post, which was in some hedges, we saw 8, then 15, then 30 turrets approaching over the hill to the left of the wart, a name the Germans had given to an ancient burial ground. The storm broke with alarming speed. The long guns emerging from the dark bodies looked like poisonous spines spitting fire and steel. They rolled forward over our line, and my vision grew dark as a few of our men stood and tried to run, the most senseless thing that they could do. By now, the tanks had reached the high ground. Our command half-track was there in the open. At high speed, the dark beasts rushed forward and past, through the hedges to our left and right, on to our rear. They were a completely new type, better than the T-34, the spawn of hell. They moved so quickly that we couldn't warn the empty vehicles. They rushed through them like a wild hunt, barely 1,000 meters behind us in a hollow. Half-tracks raced the tanks across the frozen fields. The headlong chase finally stopped at the bridge over the Dnieper, where anti-aircraft guns were positioned and shot up some of them. An anti-tank gun near us shot up 8. The other jammed just as the tanks passed it. The gun commander wept with frustration. Gradually, things calmed down. Our nerves relaxed, and the men pushed their steel helmets back. On the wide plain were 30 tanks ablaze. We could see over 60 just from where we were, knocked out yesterday and today. Welcome to episode 63 of Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin land, also called Ottawa, Canada. And before I go on, I'm going to ask you to hit that follow button to make sure you get episodes as soon as they're available. This also helps spread the word to other podcast listeners who haven't yet heard about Beyond Barbarossa. This will be the final episode of 2024. If you listen to the end, I'm going to tell you how you can win a very special prize. So don't touch that podcasting dial. Now, I want to thank, once again, author Claire Mulley, who joined us last episode to talk about Elżbieta Zawacka, Agent Zo, and Claire's book about that fearless Polish resistance fighter and agent. We had record numbers of downloads from that episode. Also, thank all of you for listening. One more thing. You can get episodes early and ad-free, plus special bonus episodes by supporting Beyond Barbarossa through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa for all the details. Now, a bit of warning, you may hear some odd sounds in the background. I apologize for that. Today, as I record, is the second day of the first snowfall in Ottawa for this year. And so there's various snow plows, trucks, and just people shoveling. So there's some noise in the background. Sorry about that. Our last narrative episode, number 61, described the Red Army's recapture of Kiev, capital of Ukraine, on 6 November 1943. The Soviets called it a liberation, but I don't believe the USSR liberated anyone. The Voronezh Front of the Red Army, and that's the front is a group of armies, was at this point, renamed the First Ukrainian Front, and they pushed the Germans about 150 kilometers west before the Germans could regroup and push them back halfway again to the Dnipro River. This left the Soviets in control of almost all of Ukraine east of the Great River. The Germans still held a few bridgeheads on the far side, and we'll get to that. But first, it's time for What Else Is Happening in the War? In Italy, in November 1943, anti-German partisan activity increases. There's bombing in Milan, which was at this point still in German hands. 18 November, heavy Allied bombing of Berlin, bringing major civilian losses. 19 November, refusing to help cover up mass murder at the Yanovsky concentration and extermination camp near Lviv, Ukraine, prisoners rise up against SS guards. 120 prisoners escape, but many are recaptured and murdered by the SS. 20 November 1943, U.S. Marines land on Tarawa in the Gilbert Islands in the Pacific, part of its island-hopping campaign. They take very heavy losses. 22nd to 26 November 1943, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek meet in the Cairo Conference to discuss their strategy to defeat Japan. The day after it ends, Churchill and Roosevelt continue to Tehran, Iran, to meet with Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin. We're going to take a closer look at that in a minute. 2nd December 1943. A German air raid on Bari, Italy, hits a cargo ship carrying mustard gas. Result, 83 Allied soldiers killed, along with another 1,000 killed by the bombs themselves. 12th December, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel of Africa Corps fame is appointed commander of Fortress Europa. In other words, he is going to be the German head of planning against the anticipated Allied offensive in France. 13 December 1943. In retaliation for the killing of 78 German soldiers by Greek partisans, the Wehrmacht's 117th Jäger Division rounded up and murdered 693 men and boys on the Aegean island of Kalavirta. 24 December. U.S. General Dwight Eisenhower is named Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. Merry Christmas, Ike. 26 December. British battleship HMS Duke of York and others in its battle group sink German capital battlecruiser Scharnhorst off North Cape, the northernmost tip of mainland Norway in the Arctic Ocean. 27 December, General Eisenhower is officially named the head of Overlord, the planned invasion of Normandy. Now, before I get into describing what's actually happening on the ground in the Eastern Front, I want to focus on two very important international conferences in Cairo and Tehran. On 22nd November 1943, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt, and Chinese national leader Chiang Kai-shek gathered in Cairo, Egypt, to discuss the strategy to defeat Imperial Japan in the Pacific. Soviet leader Joseph Stalin was invited, but he declined to attend, saying the USSR was in fact not at war with Japan. Thing is, Japan and the Soviet Union had actually signed a non-aggression agreement in 1939 before the USSR signed a similar agreement with Nazi Germany. In Cairo in 1943, Chiang, head of the Chinese nationalist, was worried that having the USSR in the alliance, as he saw it, would pose a problem for him, because the Soviets supported the Chinese communists led by Mao Zedong. In Cairo, Chiang got a commitment from the other allies to keep the Russians out of Xinjiang, as it was then called, now Xinjiang, which is a province or an autonomous republic of China in its northwest corner. Also at Cairo, here we see some of the political machinations. The British Empire still held India. Even so, Roosevelt promised Chiang that, quote, Western imperialism in Asia should come to an end with victory over Japan. He also promised that Indochina would not be returned to France, a proposal that would have infuriated de Gaulle if he had known of it, end quote. And that's from Antony Beevor's definitive book about the war called The Second World War. In other words, we can start to see that there are emerging gaps between the interests of the United States and the United Kingdom. November 1943. You've been waiting for this. The opening of the Tehran Conference. With great secrecy and much difficulty for Roosevelt, he and Churchill arrive in Tehran, Iran, to discuss war strategy in Europe with Stalin. Upon their arrival, Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov claims the Soviets have intelligence that German commandos will attempt to assassinate Roosevelt. So, he agrees to stay at the Soviet embassy in Tehran. This whole story is a fabrication. All it does is make it easier for the Soviets to spy on the Allies. Roosevelt was a great man, but he wasn't always right. Antony Beevor, as I mentioned, the author of The Definitive History of the Second World War, wrote how Roosevelt thought he could charm the Soviet dictator into doing whatever he wanted. But it turns out it was Stalin who charmed Roosevelt. For example, Roosevelt reportedly said to Stalin, when Churchill was not around, quote, "The United States and the Soviet Union are not colonial powers, and it is easier for us to discuss these matters," end quote. Not colonial powers? Ask the Ukrainians, the Georgians, Tajiks, Armenians about that. Also, on the U.S. side, you could ask the Hawaiians, the Aleuts, the Osage, the Navajo. It turns out, yes, the Soviets did put listening devices into the Americans and the British living quarters at the time. With the information they gathered, Stalin was able to exploit the differences between the interests of the US and the UK. One of these differences concerned Poland, and I think you know how that turned out. Churchill told the US president that he was helping Stalin install a communist government in Poland after the war. Roosevelt replied that Churchill was supporting an anti-communist Polish government. So, quote, "What was the difference?" End quote. I think there's a big difference, Frankie. During the conference, Churchill proposed an operation in the Adriatic, so a Western Allies operation to strike towards Central Europe. If the West did not do this, Churchill believed, all of Eastern Europe would fall into Stalin's hands. But Stalin rejected the idea immediately, and Roosevelt went along with the Soviet dictator. By 30th November, the three had agreed, and Churchill was clearly unhappy about this, and you can tell that from photos from the conference. But anyway, they agreed with Stalin's proposal to redraw Poland's borders. This effectively moved the country 50 miles or 80 kilometers west. Eastern Polish territory would become part of the Soviet republics of Belarus and Ukraine. Lithuania would also get a slice, including its former and post-war capital, Vilnius. Poland would be compensated for this loss of territory on the east with German territory on the west. Also part of this agreement was the Baltic states of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania becoming parts of the USSR, so Soviet Socialist Republics. Roosevelt insisted that this should only happen after votes in those countries, but Stalin It made sure that those referenda would be unsupervised by international observers. But more on that in a later episode. The Allies also agreed to support the communist partisans of Yugoslavia, led by Josip Broz, also known as Tito, and to cut off aid to the Chetniks, a more nationalist resistance to German occupation in Yugoslavia. The three leaders agreed on the idea of having a body of that comprised all nations in the world to resolve international disputes and promote peace. This would ultimately lead to the United Nations. The big issue, of course, was the second front that Stalin had been demanding. Roosevelt and Stalin convinced Churchill to commit to an invasion of Western Europe, probably France, in June 1944, only 7 months from the date of the conference itself. The simultaneous attack from east and west would crush the Nazis. That was the idea. It didn't quite work out that way. The three also finally agreed on the occupation of a divided Germany after the war, but they didn't agree on anything concrete in Tehran. That would happen at the next big conference on Soviet territory, Yalta, Crimea. Now that we're all caught up on the status of the war, let's look at the Eastern Front in late November 1943. After losses at Stalingrad, Kursk, and Kharkiv, the Germans decided to withdraw to a defensive line, the Ostwall. Much of that ran along the Dnipro River from northern Ukraine downstream to the Great Bend at Zaporizhia. Here, called the Wotan Line, it was supposed to run straight south from the easternmost point of the river to Melitopol and the Sea of Azov. However, after the Fourth Battle of Kharkiv, the Fourth Ukrainian Front pushed past Melitopol and the Wotan Line. And when the Red Army passed Perekop, they trapped the German 17th Army in Crimea. Even though the Red Army was up against or even over the Dnipro at most places, the Germans still held a few bridgeheads on the eastern side. One of the largest was at Nikopol. If you look at the map on the webpage for this episode, you'll see that Nikopol is downstream of that great bend where the Dnipro changes direction from south eastward to southwestward and flows down toward the Black Sea. In this little pocket on the east side of the river, or the left bank, 9 German divisions had retreated. Hitler hoped they could be part of a drive back to Melitopol and then connect with the 17th Army in Crimea. So he ordered the Wehrmacht to hold the Nikopol bridgehead in that area from Nikopol southwest to Veliki Lipetka, then known in Russia as Bolshia Lipetka. The other reason Hitler believed it was essential to hold Nikopol, well, he wanted to hold all of Ukraine and Russia, was that around Nikopol were manganese mines, and manganese is used to make steel. It's an essential ingredient. But the 9 divisions in that pocket, in that bridgehead, were in sorry shape. Most of the battalions had fewer than 200 men left. Additionally, they had had to abandon a lot of their heavy equipment, including artillery, as they retreated from points farther east. They also didn't have enough ammunition, and morale, understandably, was low. So, General Ferdinand Schorner, a deeply committed Nazi, was brought in to command the 49th Panzer Corps, plus the units in the bridgehead. Combining all these would create the Gruppe Schorner. They also received a group of Ferdinand tank destroyers, those things known as elephants. They're basically Tiger tanks without the turret and equipped with a single huge 88mm gun. Facing them was the 4th Ukrainian Front, commanded by Fyodor Tolbukhin. It comprised 3 full armies, plus a tank corps and a guards mechanized corps in reserve. The Red Army soldiers apparently exhibited high morale, Doubtless, they were tired. They had been fighting and advancing almost continuously for 4 months now. But they'd also been winning during those 4 months, pushing the invaders back. And as they moved forward, reconquering German-occupied territory, they kept finding evidence of the brutality of the Germans. The famous Soviet war correspondent Vasily Grossman traveled with the 75th Guards Rifle Division as it advanced westward and wrote this. "Old men, when they hear Soviet words, run to meet the troops and weep silently, unable to utter a word. Old peasant women say with quiet surprise, 'We thought we would sing and laugh when we saw our army, but there's so much grief in our hearts that tears are falling.' Every soldier, every officer, and every general of the Red Army who had seen the Ukraine in blood and fire, who had heard the true story of what had been happening in the Ukraine during the 2 years of German rule, understands to the bottom of their souls that there are only two sacred words left to us. One of them is love, and the other is revenge. According to what prisoners said and letters found on dead German soldiers, the Germans considered themselves the representatives of a higher race forced to live in savage villages." End quote. So yes, that's what the Soviets found evidence of as to the German attitude toward the Russians and Ukrainians. Bill Downs was an American correspondent for CBS covering the Russian front, as it was called at the time. So he was there as well. Soon after the Red Army drove the Germans out of Kiev, he was one of a number of Western journalists who visited Babyn Yar, also called in Russian Babi Yar, the notorious ravine in Kiev, where the Germans murdered more than 100,000 Ukrainian Jews and others they didn't like, communists, anyone they just, didn't like. So here's an excerpt from his report from that visit. "From what I saw, I am convinced that one of the most horrible tragedies in this Nazi era occurred there between September 1941 and November 1943. The first act in the tragedy took place in September 1941, a few weeks after the Germans captured Kiev. One day they ordered all Jews to report at the Lukyanovka district and bring their valuables with them. Thousands of men, women, and children marched out to Lukyanovka, thinking they would probably be evacuated. Instead, Nazi SS troops led them to Babi Yar. At the wide, shallow ravine, their valuables and part of their clothing were removed and heaped into a big pile. Then groups of these people were led into a neighboring deep ravine where they were machine gunned. When bodies covered the ground in more or less of a layer, SS men scraped sand down from the ravine walls to cover them. Then the shooting would continue. The Nazis, we were told, worked 3 days doing the job. However, even more incredible was the action taken by the Nazis between August 19 and September 28 last. Vilkas, an eyewitness to the atrocities who guided the journalists on this tour, said that in the middle of August, the SS mobilized a party of 100 Russian war prisoners who were taken to the ravines. On August 19, these men were ordered to disinter all the bodies in the ravine. The Germans, meanwhile, took a party to a nearby Jewish cemetery, whence marble headstones were brought to Babi Yar to form the foundation of a huge funeral pyre. Atop the stones were piled a layer of wood, and then a layer of bodies, and so on, until the pyre was as high as a two-story house. Vilkas said that approximately 1,500 bodies were burned in each operation of the furnace, and each funeral pyre took 2 nights and 1 day to burn completely. The cremation went on for 40 days. And then the prisoners, who by this time included 341 men, were ordered to build another furnace. Since this was the last furnace, and there were no more bodies, the prisoners decided it was for them. They made a break, but only a dozen out of more than 200 survived the bullets of the Nazi guns. As substantiating evidence, while walking over the mass graves, I saw bits of hair, bones, and a crushed skull with bits of flesh and hair still attached. Walking down the ravine, I constantly came across shoes, spectacle cases, and in one place found gold bridgework. The most persistent question that presents itself is why the Nazis took such pains to cover this tragedy. Previously, the Germans made little effort to conceal their pogroms in any occupied territory. If in their retreat they intended to try to cover their crimes, this represents a new and significant policy which presupposes the possibility of defeat. End quote. Now, after that, I think we all need a little break. I'm going to get some more coffee. You get yourself some water or anything stronger that you might need. When we get back, we'll hear about the Red Army's revenge. This episode is brought to you by the Eastern Front Trilogy, the true story of a Canadian, Maurice Bury, drafted into the Soviet Red Army in 1941, just in time to be thrown between the jaws of the USSR and Nazi Germany at the launch of the greatest land invasion in history, the monstrous war called Operation Barbarossa. In three volumes, Army of Worn Souls, Under the Nazi Heel, and Walking Out of War. The Eastern Front Trilogy is the story of the largest and deadliest side of the Second World War, seen through the eyes of a man who was there from the earliest days in 1941, through Germany's grinding occupation of Ukraine, and finally to the savage end of the war in Berlin. You can find the three individual volumes as ebooks exclusively on Amazon, or purchase a three-volume complete paperback on any online book retailer, or at your local bookstore. To learn more about the Eastern Front Trilogy, visit scottburyauthor.com.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel, and all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now, let's get back to Scott, exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Welcome back to episode 63 of Beyond Barbarossa, the only English language podcast that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. And I want to thank you for coming back after that last bit. That was probably the hardest thing I've ever had to read aloud. That shows you that there's little wonder that the Red Army soldiers were out for revenge in 1943. Still, they were up against a number of weaknesses that would get in the way of their vengeance. For one, the Red Army units had a high proportion of recent recruits, and you can probably figure out why. Again, to quote from Prit Butar, the training of these drafts was generally poorer than had been the case in previous battles, and there is little time to allow these men to learn from veterans. Increasingly, the German opponents reported the use of mass human wave attacks as commanders attempted to make up for poor training by sheer weight of numbers. However, there were plenty of experienced, battle-hardened troops in the 4th Ukrainian Front, and the balance of power lay very firmly with the Soviet forces. End quote. On 4th November, the Soviet 31st Rifle Corps of the 4th Ukrainian Front attacked the center of the Nikopol bridgehead, penetrating to the village of Rogatchik. General Schorner, commander of the German army group named for him, sent in the 24th Panzer Division, destroying the attackers and pushing them back by the 7th of November. Tolbukhin, commander of the 4th Ukrainian Front, regrouped and brought in reinforcements. They assaulted with various tactics at different places along that front line of that bridgehead. They attacked on 20th November, 26th November, 19th December, and the Germans' Christmas present, 25th December, was another attack. Each time, the Germans managed to scramble their diminishing numbers and pushed the Red Army back. The 4th Ukrainian Front made its last attempt of 1943 to retake the Nikopol bridgehead on New Year's Eve, 31st December 1943. Despite heavy fighting and heavy losses on both sides, much, much higher for the Soviets, the Germans held on. Now, the fighting at Nikopol was not the only action happening in Army Group South's area, nor along the rest of the Eastern Front. After the recapture of Kiev, Vatutin's Voronezh Front, renamed the 1st Ukrainian Front, pushed Hermann Hoth's 4th Panzer Army back to Zhytomyr, 90 miles or 150 kilometers west of Kiev. The Germans then pushed the Red Army halfway back to the Dnipro. Both generals got hell from the commanders after this. Hitler fired Hoth for not getting all the way back to the river. Thus, he took one of the most capable and experienced and effective German generals off the field. Stalin likewise scolded Vatutin for only advancing 45 miles after recapturing the Ukrainian capital. But Vatutin kept his job. Erhard Raus replaced Hoth as commander of the 4th Panzer Army and recaptured Zhytomyr on 20 November. Hermann Belk, commander of the 48th Panzer Corps, which was part of the 4th Panzer Army, was determined to continue and retake Kiev. But while his corps made progress, their losses were starting to show. The medical officer of the 8th Panzer Division, part of this group, wrote, quote, "Almost 100% of the Panzer Grenadiers have foot problems. These are mainly due to the overexertions of the joints, muscles, and ligaments, resulting in swelling. In addition, due to the universal infestation with lice, there are numerous infections from scratching skin. About 80% of the combat strength are suffering from illnesses related to the cold." End quote. Even so, this group managed to encircle the town of Brusilov. In doing so, they destroyed or captured 153 Soviet tanks, 70 artillery pieces, and 250 anti-tank guns. Now, all the action going on between Zhytomyr and Kiev convinced the Stavka, the Soviet high command, that the Germans were determined to try to retake Kiev. So, Georgi Zhukov, Stalin's right-hand man and the most famous Soviet general of the war, there's a special series about him for Patreon supporters, ordered General Nikolai Vatutin, commander of the 1st Ukrainian Front, to prepare for the German offensive. Vatutin gathered, well, powerful doesn't really capture it. As a main strike force, he had the 18th and 38th Armies, plus the 1st Guards Army, and the 1st and 3rd Guards Tank Armies. Guards was an honorific given to units that had achieved something significant. You know, they were the, not quite the elite, but counted as better than the run-of-the-mill Red Army forces. The 1st Guards Tank Army at this point, so this is just one of Vatutin's groups operating in this area, by itself, the 1st Guards Tank Army at this point had about 600 tanks and self-propelled guns. By itself, it was stronger than all the panzer units it would face. These were the units arrayed for a fresh attack towards Zhytomyr and Berdychev. once they had engaged the German reserves in the area, the 60th Army would attack the Germans' left or northern flank. One thing, though, before we go on, all these units of all these armies were below the strength they had on paper. Rather than 8,000 to 10,000 men per division, most divisions were between 4,500 and 6,000 men. And of these, only half had their winter uniforms and boots in December in Ukraine. Still, these were Red Army soldiers, and they followed orders, even though they suffered and knowing they'd likely die. They got ready. Early on 24 December, Christmas Eve on the Western calendar, the artillery of the 38th Army began a heavy bombardment. Its commander, General Kirill Moskalenko, described it this way. This was how the eve of the third and last Christmas in Soviet territory began for the Hitlerites. On the first occasion in 1941, the Soviet armed forces ruined the invaders' festivities, smashing them near Moscow. The Nazis experienced the second Christmas in the encirclement in Stalingrad, dreaming in vain of escaping from the ring of our troops. And now, in December 1943, the Red Army once again assaulted them, but they had nobody to blame but themselves. Uninvited, they brought grief to the Soviet people and unprecedented suffering. But the hour of reckoning had come, and it was time for the cruel enemy to receive vengeance in full. End quote. After the bombardment, the Red Army moved forward without encountering much opposition. They brushed off counterattacks easily, and by nightfall, which happens early on Christmas Eve, after all, the Soviets were on the outskirts of Brusilov. Moskalenko ordered a late attack that night, and they took the town by sunrise on Christmas Day. The next day, the 1st Guards Tank Army captured the town of Popilnia. There, they captured a German supply train that pulled in. Red Army soldiers found supplies being sent to the German soldiers for Christmas. Chocolate, wine, warm clothes, mittens. Commander General Mikhail Katakov said, quote, "The Hitlerite command gave its soldiers material looted from the enslaved countries of Western Europe." End quote. North of there, General Balk of the 40th Panzer Corps was ordered to give up the drive on Kiev and counterattack the Soviet drive towards Zhytomyr. He arrived in the city on Christmas Day, only to find all the German rear units destroying documents and loading trucks to bug out. But they were already too late. The Liebstandarte Adolf Hitler Division was fighting hard, and the 19th Panzer Division reported it was surrounded and running out of fuel. The 8th Panzer Division, along with some Tiger tanks from the Adolf Hitler Division, counterattacked on 26 December. But they ran into a solid line of anti-tank guns and could only keep the Red Army at bay. By the end of 26 December, hey, that's my birthday, the 1st Panzer Division was down to 100 men per battalion and had only 4 Panther tanks in operating condition. Now, the Panthers were supposed to be an answer to the Soviet T-34. They had sloping armor and a very powerful gun. But they were prone to breakdown. At one point, the Liebstandarte Adolf Hitler Division had just 28 tanks and assault guns left, 6 of them being Panthers. Another 53 tanks were in the repair shop, not due to battle damage, but mechanical breakdowns. This was symptomatic of the Wehrmacht's mechanical armor problems, challenges, on the Eastern Front, and not just on the Eastern Front, but everywhere. They were wonderful machines, but boy, did they require a lot of maintenance. By the end of 27 December, the Liebstandarte Adolf Hitler Division was in a defensive posture, with just 5 Tiger tanks, 13 Panzers, 11 Panzer IVs, and 12 assault guns. On New Year's Eve, the Germans abandoned Zhytomyr for the last time. So here we are, at the end of the year of 1943, as well as 2024. More than ever before, we can see the futility of Germany's attack on the USSR. In 1941, the Wehrmacht had the most advanced weapons and armor in the world. They had the best trained soldiers with the most experienced, professional, innovative, and empirically successful leaders. They had conquered Central and Western Europe. But it turns out numbers matter, as does determination to defend your homeland. The Soviet Union proved that. 1 year earlier, at the end of 1942, the Germans were at the Volga and the slopes of the Caucasus Mountains. They controlled virtually all of Europe, directly or through their allies and puppets. Through 1943, the Red Army drove them back 1,200 kilometers, or 800 miles. The Germans fought a textbook retreat. There was nothing you could criticize about their fighting retreat. But in the process, they lost hundreds of thousands of casualties to the point where units were down to a tenth of their original strength. Not only in Ukraine, but in Russia and Belarusia too. The Red Army recaptured Smolensk in September and pushed into Belarusia by the end of the year. Meanwhile, the British, Canadians, and Americans were grinding their way north in Italy. Even so, at the end of 1943, Germany still occupied huge territories in the east. Half of Ukraine, half of Belarusia, all the Baltic states, all of Poland, and all the countries there west. Romania and Bulgaria were puppets, Yugoslavia and Greece occupied, and Western Europe was firmly under their control. The Germans also held Crimea and swathes of northwestern Russia. They continued to strangle the USSR's second city, Leningrad. And so now, listeners, as I lower the curtain on 1943 in Eastern Europe, the sun sets on 2024. Beyond Barbarossa is taking a break for the season, and we'll be back to see what 1944 will bring in 2025. The podcasting year will begin, for us anyway, with a look back at 1939 to 1941. Historian Roger Moorhouse will join us to look at the impact of the Nazi-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact and his book, The Devil's Alliance, Hitler's Pact with Stalin, 1939 to 1941. That will be on your podcatcher on 6th January 2025. It's a great episode, and I really love what Roger Moorhouse has to say. So, I will talk to you then. For now, happy holidays, listeners, wherever you are and whatever you celebrate. And thank you for listening to Beyond Barbarossa, still the only podcast focused on the Eastern Front of the Second World War. If you haven't yet, please hit that follow button on your podcast app. That helps others interested in this part of history find the show. As usual, I put maps and photos on the webpage for this episode, beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. Just remember to click on the title of the episode to see them, not on the image, unless you want to listen to the episode in your browser, which is fine. You can also listen to the episode on my own website, writtenword.ca. Click on the podcast button in the banner. Thanks to all who have supported the podcast through Patreon. Your support helps make this podcast possible. If you like this episode, please follow Beyond Barbarossa on your podcasting app. And if you have a couple of minutes, a rating or review would make a huge difference. Do you have a question, a comment, something to add? Did you find a mistake? Oh, I hope not. Send your thoughts by email to contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. I'd love to hear from you. And to prove that, I'm going to enter all commenters into a random draw for a signed paperback copy of my book about the war, the Eastern Front Trilogy. So, send away. Again, that's contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until we can connect again in the new year, don't keep your paddles in the water. Stay warm. I'll see you in 2025. Slava Ukraina.